From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Sleep deprivation is the oldest form of torture, and it's still widely practiced in many totalitarian regimes.
Today we dive under the covers and explore the world of sleep and dreams. A novelist introduces us to the world of Bengali dream tellers.
When someone would tell their dream to this dream teller, the parrot would whisper into her ear, and she said that the parrot was giving her direction.
And imagine merely thinking a wish, then watching it happen. One researcher says that's the potential behind lucid dreaming. Also, we'll explore the nighttime world of champion sleep talker, Diane McGregor.
Pull it tight, watch it go around. Ooh, wee! Circle, concentric circles. Put that go around, wee!
Next time you curl up under the covers, remember this. According to some statistics, we spend a third of our lives asleep, and much of that time, dreaming. But even science isn't certain why we dream, or what dreams mean. That's where Andrea Rock comes in. She's the author of a new book called The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. She told Steve Paulson that the mysteries of dreaming have yet to be revealed.
There have been all kinds of competing theories about the purpose of dreaming. Some people claim that, well, it's just an accidental byproduct of the fact that the human brain is programmed to spin stories and make sense of whatever information it receives, you know, whether it's nonsensical or not. But there is some persuasive and mounting evidence that there may have been a biological reason for the stage of sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, to evolve originally in mammals. And that was that it became a period for processing survival-related information when the brain's offline and doesn't have to worry about being eaten by the saber-toothed tiger and so on. And there's been recent experiments that show that that process of incorporating important information from daily experience at night during the dreaming phase of sleep is, in fact, an important part of what's going on. There was a fascinating study done at MIT in animals. They were training rats to go through a maze in search of these little food rewards, and they were recording from their brain cells as they were traveling in the maze when they were awake, and then they just happened to keep the recording going on when the animals were asleep and discovered that, in fact, the exact same firing patterns that they saw when the rats were learning a new part of the maze were repeated when they went into rapid eye movement sleep, the dreaming stage of sleep, and the match was so precise that they could pinpoint where in the maze they were, you know, in their dream.
So that's one interpretation of why we dream, that it's almost like a computer in our brain, that we need to process this information that we may have been exposed to during the day or maybe during the previous week, and somehow our brain needs help to synthesize it, and we've got to do that when we're sleeping.
Right. And in fact, when you look at some of the studies of people who've gone through trauma, you see a consistent pattern that they will go through essentially a repeat of the experience as it occurred initially. And then over a period of time, as that experience is integrated with more positive memories in the memory bank, the dreams tend to change and have a more positive outcome. I cited in the book a couple of examples that were post-9/11 dreams, one of which involved an air traffic controller who had guided the flight that landed, unfortunately, in the Pentagon. And in her dream, initially, she would have a replay of the experience as it happened, and then over time, the dream changed, and she was able to reach into the radar scope, and instead of watching helplessly as the blip continued into the building, she was able to cradle the plane in her hand and prevent any harm from happening, and after that point, she stopped having the nightmare version of the dream.
I mean, it sort of makes you wonder how far you can take that, whether if, for instance, you're the kind of person who is plagued by nightmares or at least anxiety dreams, whether if you somehow learn to dream differently, whether you can reduce the bad dreams and increase the good ones.
Actually, yes. There are people who are doing research about just that. You know, if you can do sort of a rehearsal in waking hours to try to direct the course of the dream and change the course of the dream, particularly negative ones. Rosalind Cartwright in Chicago has been doing work on this for years with people going through divorce who are suffering depression after divorce. And one of the examples she gives, I think, is a great one, where a woman who was going through a divorce from a husband who had been very domineering and it was very emotionally upsetting, first had a dream that the husband came, ex-husband came into her apartment, which had a beautiful white carpet, and he walked all over it in muddy boots, and she was very upset in the dream, and obviously a good visual metaphor for the problems that they had in waking life. And so the researcher was encouraging her to try to envision having a different ending to the dream, you know, if she had another dream like that, taking charge, speaking up for herself, that sort of thing. And so then she reported a couple nights later she had another dream in which she was going up in an elevator that had no walls around it and was terrifying, rising up story after story. And suddenly she decided, she was lying down on the floor of this elevator, and she decided to stand up. And as soon as she stood up, four walls popped up around her in the elevator, and she was completely safe and felt wonderful, woke up, and it was that kind of sort of transforming dream, and she had deliberately made herself stand up in the dream. And so part of that was, you know, the rehearsal in waking life. And in fact, the positive experience that she felt in the dream, the change in the dream, transferred in her waking hours, and she became more assertive at work and with the ex-husband. So there's a real interesting kind of back and forth play from waking life to dream life.
That's a great story.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the big mysteries out there right now among dream researchers?
Well, they're still trying to look at dreaming as a way of determining what the nature of consciousness itself is. What is it that actually allows us to be aware of our emotions, to plan ahead, to do this kind of creative thought process that humans can do? And there are some researchers that are trying to actually pinpoint what it is, which areas of the brain turn on to create that sense of consciousness, whether it can actually be narrowed down to a specific set of brain cells. So that's part of the Holy Grail, is looking at that. And it's fascinating because when you look at how, when we're dreaming, the visual images are as real life. I mean, it feels absolutely real. And how can that be? You know, because we think that we see with our eyes, and if our eyes are closed, how can we be having this completely real visual experience? And so that's one of the areas that they're looking at to actually study the nature of consciousness, is looking at how we see. And in one of those experiments, they were showing a patient images of various people, and they were recording from specific brain cells that are among those that are very active in dreaming. And they found that she had a specific small group of brain cells that fired only when she looked at drawings or photographs of former President Bill Clinton.
Is this whole area of dream research something that the military is working on? I mean, do they want to try to apply the way we dream?
Well, it's interesting because some of the best source of funding recently for sleep and dream research has come from an arm of the Defense Department, the Defense Advanced Research Project, which does really kind of on-the-edge stuff. And, you know, it's amazing to think that we do all kinds of space exploration and other kinds of technologically advanced stuff, but yet we still really don't understand why it is, in fact, that we sleep at all. And so what they're doing is funding research to try to determine why we need sleep and if we can do without it, because their goal is to have soldiers who can go for 2 weeks straight without sleep. And so they're funding some research. Dolphins only sleep with one half of the brain at a time, one hemisphere at a time, and they can go for long periods without sleep, as can some migrating birds. So they're funding research to try to see if we can figure out why that is possible in dolphins and birds, and whether there's some way to transfer that to humans to accomplish that military objective.
So trying to train a new kind of soldier that doesn't need to sleep.
Yeah, and it's a little, I mean, you know, we have to approach doing that kind of stuff with some trepidation, because as research continues, we're understanding more and more that there are all kinds of important things that are going on during sleep that we you know, are only beginning really to understand. And so to kind of be plunging into doing away with it before we fully understand why we have to do it in the first place should give us some pause.
Andrea Rock is an award-winning journalist and author of the book The Mind at Night. Steve Paulson spoke with her. The singular thing about all dreams seems to be that they're private. Only the dreamer knows for sure what happened. It's true for everyone except, so it would seem, Dion McGregor. By day, McGregor was a New York lyricist with one hit to his name. By night, he was the ultimate sleep talker. Producer Steve Venright collected some of McGregor's dreams on the new CD, The Further Somniloquies of Dion McGregor, from Torpor Vigil Industries. So what made Dion McGregor so special?
He didn't just talk in his sleep. He told full-blown narratives, sometimes delirious rants. And the good fortune is that his roommate and songwriting partner, Michael Barr, was an amateur recordist who would set up a microphone and a reel-to-reel tape recorder each morning. And about four or five mornings of the week, Dion would launch into what became known as his somniloquies.
Wait, was he aware that this was going on? I mean, did Michael Barr tell him that he was recording him?
Yes, he knew at that point. And since he was a child, off and on anyway, he'd been told that he spoke in his sleep. But it wasn't until shortly before he met Michael Barr that another roommate alerted him to this fact and started to jot down some of the dreams in longhand. But it wasn't working because his vocal delivery was so rapid that the guy couldn't keep up with him. So when he ended up moving in and taking, I think, either the couch or the twin bed in Mike Barr's living room, then Barr got very excited about these nocturnal transmissions and set up his microphone. And at that point, Dion was aware that he was being recorded and that sometimes others would sit in on the sessions for a laugh or just in disbelief.
Yeah.
And it was almost a nuisance for him, really. He wasn't all that interested in his dreams, but he humored his friends.
Now, I mean, this was apparently fairly widely known within a cult. I mean, I confess, I never heard of Dion McGregor. I didn't know who he was until I started listening to this CD. But there is a cult following around him, isn't it?
I think that's a good way of putting it. Those who know his work are outrageously enthusiastic about it. And
you say people go nuts about it.
Yeah, they're quite wild. Well, I'll just briefly explain my first encounter with it. I was camping about a dozen summers ago with my family, and a friend of ours happened to be at the same campsite and brought over a cassette. This happened to be Christopher Dewdney, who's a well-known Canadian author, and he introduced me to the works of Dion McGregor. We played some tapes by the campfire that night, and I can remember rolling in the dirt. I thought they were the most hilarious things I'd ever heard, but there was also a strangely poignant and sometimes haunting and often even terrifying quality to them.
Okay, enough with the teasing of people here. You brought along the new CD of Dion McGregor you've put out. Let's listen to something. What do you want to hear first?
I think the first introduction that might be the way to go would be something called South Sea Squirm. Dion's love of mangoes, whether he loved them when he was awake or not, I don't know. But when he's asleep, as you'll hear, he certainly had a fondness for mangoes.
Here it is.
Everybody's eating mangoes. We're mango mad in this country. It's mango mad. Wee-dee-dee-doo. Ha-ta-ta-ta-ta. Mango. Have a mango. Have a mango. Have a mango. Myrna mango. Myrna mango. Myrna mango. Myrna mango. Step right up, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to meet Myrna Mango. She'll give you a display of one of those South Sea squirms like of which you've never seen before. Shake it, Myrna. Oh, wow.
That's astonishing. And this is all a somniloquy, you call it. This is sleep
a somniloquy, yes, exactly. And you hear the musical quality of that dream. Often songs emerged in his sleep. In fact, he claims that some of his ideas for lyrics came from songs or came from dreams. So that's one example of melodies emerging in his sleep.
Yeah, it is a little bit like eavesdropping on somebody's subconscious, isn't it?
It's strangely voyeuristic. Now, that dream was fairly benign, you might say, but a lot of his dreams end with him screaming or dying or even falling out of bed at times. I'm sure that's the sound that I hear. So you'd think that he was quite a troubled soul when he was awake, and you'd be almost afraid to meet him. And there were a couple radio shows done in the 60s. When you hear his voice when he was awake, it was actually very mellifluous and calm and pleasant, and he claims that he really wasn't troubled by much at all, and perhaps he got all his anxiety out in his sleep.
Well, let's listen to another one. What do you have next?
I have one of my recent favorites. Again, these are shorter dreams. Some of the dreams are up to a dozen minutes long, but here's at least part of another short one called Concentric Circles.
Pull it tight now. Watch it whirl. Watch it whirl. Pull it tight and watch it whirl. Whee! Look at it go. Look at it go. Look at it go. Circle, circle, circle. Woo! Pull it tight. Watch it whirl. Concentric circles. Concentric circles. Look at that. Down. Whoo! Whee! Look at it go around. Oh, isn't it pretty? Isn't it pretty? Pull it tight. Pull it tight. Watch it go around. Woo! Whee! Circle, circle, circle. Concentric circles. Look at that go around. Woo! Oh, you're not pulling it tight enough. You're not pulling it tight enough. It's slackening. Slackening. It's slackening. Look at that. Look at that. Circles, circles. Concentric circles. Watch it go around. Oh! One's going one way, one's going the other way.
Did anybody ever do any analysis of these? I mean, did he ever bring a psychiatrist in to say this means that you actually wish you were a track star?
I'm not sure if he had analysis of that type. There was a Dr. Valentin Wolf Zetlin, who was a psychiatrist who sat in on some of his sessions. And what the doctor had to say, I don't know. It would be a lot of fun to analyze these. And there's one dream on a previous recording where Diane seems to analyze what he's saying. We're just within the dream. So they're curious kind of commentaries within the larger narratives of the dreams themselves.
You want to leave us with one more dream?
Sure. This is called The Horseshoe Crabs. I'm not sure if you'll have time to hear it all, but to me it has qualities of Edgar Allan Poe meets Lewis Carroll. It's a seaside tale, that's all I'll say, and I'll leave your listeners to enjoy The Horseshoe Crabs.
The horseshoe crabs came out and peeked. Oh, and they peeked and they winked. Horseshoe crabs, big as fists. Yes, horseshoe crabs as big as fists kept along. Crept along and kept along, too. Oh, those waves. Yes, there's waves, dark waves, lowering clouds, horseshoe crabs. It was all very, very timorous. It was almost sunset time. Sunset time. Sunset time at the beach with the lowering clouds. Very threatening. And everybody took out their bananas. Then up and down that beach to a swift marching song.
A dream called The Horseshoe Crabs on the CD The Further Somniloquies of Diane McGregor. Steve Venright produced the CD for his self-created label Torpor Vigil Industries. You can find further information about Diane McGregor by logging onto our website. It's www.ttbook.org. And drop us a note while you're there. We always love to hear from you. Coming up, the strange world of lucid dreaming.
Many people describe having had one or two lucid dreams that were the most important, valuable, and meaningful experiences of their entire lives.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Dreams can be a seething world of chaos, or your own personal amusement park. That is, if you master the art of lucid dreaming. Stephen LaBerge pioneered the field of lucid dreaming research at Stanford, and he's the author of the book Lucid Dreaming, A Concise Guide to Awakening in Your Dreams and in Your Life. LaBerge told Steve Paulson what lucid dreaming is.
Lucid dreaming simply is dreaming while knowing that you are dreaming. Well, that sounds like something, well, don't you do that all the time? Well, only when you wake up and say, oh, that was a dream. So we don't usually tell ourselves, well, it's happening. This is a dream. If we do, we then know what sort of circumstance we're in, and it gives us new opportunities for dream control, etc. I think lucid dreaming would be better called cognizant dreaming. Cognizant means doing whatever it is you're doing and knowing that you're doing it.
So you are both dreaming and you're aware that you're dreaming.
Exactly. You are vividly dreaming. You are completely in the dream world, yet you know, as you might know a fact, that you are asleep in bed at the time, and therefore that everything that's happening is in your own mind.
But how do you know you're really asleep, that you're not just lying awake thinking that you're dreaming?
That is really a kind of a technical question about how do we know that this is sleep? Experientially, that's what it's like. For example, if I were having a lucid dream now, I might say, oh, well, here I am, what I thought was a studio a moment ago, but now I'm floating up to the ceiling, and that means this is a dream. So now I remember, well, I must be asleep in bed. That's right, I'm sleeping in the lab, and we've got electrodes on me, so I'm going to now make a signal to the lab to say, yes, I know I'm dreaming. And I do that just by looking to the left and the right and the left and the right. And then on the computer screen, we will see eye movement corresponding to that left, right, and in the context of rapid eye movement sleep. And they say, ah, this guy is showing rapid eye movement or REM or paradoxical sleep. There's no question that he's asleep. His experience says he's fully in that dream world. So given that we have the consistency between the subjective experience, what I experience in the dream being fully there, I don't feel myself in bed. I'm not aware of the surroundings, but I'm aware of the dream world I'm in, plus the physiology as measured by EEG, brain waves, and so on, that determine it is the state of REM sleep. It's a very curious, amazing situation, but true.
When did you first realize that you could be a lucid dreamer yourself?
Well, when I was 5 years old, I used to have a series of interesting serial underwater sea pirate dreams. I had gone to Saturday matinees, and they had, you know, the serials that would continue on night after night. And after having a fabulous underwater adventure dream one night, I thought, well, why couldn't I go back to that same dream tonight and continue just as the serial movies do? And what do you know? That next night, there I was. And all I had to do is simply think, I want to go back to that dream tonight. And so I went through that for months, actually, of these undersea adventure dreams.
Now, I know you have been studying lucid dreaming for years now, and I'm sure you've worked with many people. Are there common kinds of lucid dreams that people have?
Of course, the dreams of one person or the other will vary tremendously, but I think there's a common theme through many of them. You can just imagine it for yourself. You realize you're dreaming, okay? So what do you want to do now? So right now, it's all in your mind. You could do anything. For example, you've heard about flying. So you're going to want to say, okay, let's see, can I do it? And you step into the air and you float. And then you go floating out the window and you look around you and say, what's this? Where am I? Wow, look, this looks so real, but it's a different place or something. What is this? And you start exploring it. And so I'd say, essentially, exploration and adventure is probably the main theme of lucid dreams, where people are just fascinated with being in this world that clearly is somehow a construction of their own minds, yet it's so complex that it's, you know, at least as complex as the waking perceptual world.
There is sort of an obvious question that comes from this, is I'm guessing that if lucid dreaming is sort of an area where your fantasies can play out because you have control over this, I mean, do people want to have sex in lucid dreaming? And then is there a real physiological response there?
Well, I don't know. Would you? Well, of course they do. That, in fact, is one of the most popular themes. I'd say it's right there next to flying. Flying and dream sex. After all, dream sex is the only safe sex these days anyway. But we indeed have done experiments in which we measured the physiology associated with orgasm and lucid dreams and found it to be exactly the same as one gets with the waking state. The experiences can be extremely vivid. In fact, if you look at the writings of Patricia Garfield, such as Pathway to Ecstasy and Creative Dreaming, you'll see she describes orgasmic experiences in lucid dreams that go far beyond her waking state. And she thinks that lucid dreaming is essentially orgasmic because it happens so frequently with her and her students. But I think it depends on the person, what you're interested in. We do know that in REM sleep or paradoxical sleep, we have an activated brain that also is associated with sexual activation, that males have erections and females have equivalent sexual activation. It seems like there's probably an evolutionary function to that that prepares for having sex and procreation.
So what you're saying here is that you can learn how to do all of this. I mean, whatever kind of lucid dream you want. How do you go about becoming a good lucid dreamer?
Well, lucid dreaming is learnable. And if you think about, for example, language, that we speak a complex language, very difficult, but how do we learn that? Well, we were taught. Our parents and the people around us spoke the language and they taught us to speak. Nobody teaches us to dream. So it's not surprising that people haven't developed the skill, but the basic method is to enhance your awareness of your dreaming in general. The first step is to increase dream recall, because if you don't remember your dreams very often when you're awake, you don't have much of an idea of what they are. But if you remember them every night, for example, and for really good dream recallers, including myself, that would be typically three or four times a night. Every REM period of the night, you can wake up from the dream and remember it. If you can do that, then you can start to think about, oh, what is dream like about that dream? What's different from the waking state? Namely, various oddities and inconsistencies because there's no external structure to keep it stabilized. And so from that, you can then say, all right, tonight when I'm dreaming, I want to remember to notice that I'm dreaming. I want to recognize I'm dreaming. So it's a prospective memory or memory for intentions.
Can you tell me about either one of your dreams or the dream of someone you've worked with that has been truly transformative?
Yes. A good example is a dream I had in which for the first maybe 40 or 50 lucid dreams I had were typically some kind of nightmare, realizing I'm dreaming, and then I'd fly away from whatever the problem is, you know, the angry mob, the police, the underworld, whatever. And on about the 40th lucid dream, I have a dream in which I'm doing the same thing, running away from some unpleasant situation, and then I believe I wake up. And at this point, I find myself in an audience listening to Idris Shah, a teacher I respected a great deal, talking about Stephen's dream. And he said, oh, it was excellent that Stephen realized that he was dreaming and therefore he could fly, but too bad that he didn't realize that because it was a dream, there was nothing to flee. Now, that was so clear. In other words, the fact that I've been running away from, in the same way as people wake up from a nightmare, instead I was flying away. So I wanted to get away, so I was getting away better. So I applied that idea in the following dream, after working at this for actually some months, in which I find myself in the midst of a riot in the classroom. And here everybody is throwing chairs around and beating on everybody else. And in the middle of that, I'm in the grip of a 10-foot-tall ogre, really. And I said, this is a shadow figure if I've ever seen one. And I come to in the dream. I realize this is a dream because I've never met an ogre before. And I resolve that I'm going to befriend him because that's the way out of the conflict dreams. And so I look at him with the intention of saying something nice, and I feel overwhelmed with revulsion and disgust. Oh, this is, geez, just too ugly and barbaric. So I try another approach. I say, that's not going to work. So I first get in touch with love. I remember, what is compassion? I feel it. Then I look him in the eyes, and words of loving acceptance flow out of me intuitively, just directly. He then embraces me. He melts into my heart, and I wake up feeling wonderfully together. And so that dream was, first of all, an experience of integration, of first starting with a conflict, of a separation where there's another part of myself that I'm fighting with, that ogre. You know, it's the part of my humanity that I don't want to accept. And by the end of the dream, I have become one with it. I've accepted it. It has, harmony now has appeared, which is exactly what I want to achieve with lucid dreaming, which is to accept what I find myself to be.
Do you think lucid dreaming really matters in our lives? I mean, obviously, it can be kind of thrilling or exciting to have one of these dreams, but when we're back to our waking selves, will we somehow benefit from having these lucid dreams?
And many people describe having had one or two lucid dreams that were the most important, valuable, and meaningful experiences of their entire lives. Not, you know, just, boy, that was a lot of fun. And the Tibetan Buddhists have been practicing a yoga of the dream state for over 1,000 years, where they use lucid dreaming as a means of spiritual progress. And to them, there's nothing more important in the world than the idea of developing wisdom and compassion through a integrative process using one's dreams, becoming conscious of them, first of all, learning to control them, and then learning to recognize that it is all a dream, waking or dreaming alike.
Oh, life could be a dream if I could take you up in paradise up above. If you would tell me I'm the only one that you love. Life could be a dream, sweetheart. Hello, hello again. Shaboom, and hoping we'll meet again.
Stephen LaBerge pioneered the field of lucid dreaming research at Stanford University. He's the founder of the Lucidity Institute and the author of the book, Lucid Dreaming. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni is no stranger to the wonders of the mind at night. She immersed herself in dreams and their meanings for her latest novel. It's called Queen of Dreams. It tells the story of a dream teller and her daughter living in California. Devakaruni says she's always been interested in dreams.
Right from childhood, I grew up in a family where dreams were a big part of our lives, and really in a culture, because I grew up in a very traditional Bengali culture, dreams were a part of most people's lives. I remember that sometimes at the dinner table, if we had an interesting dream, we would talk about it, and then my mother would interpret it for us. And I think sometimes, you know, she inserted little bits of mother wisdom into her interpretation. But it got me very intrigued, but more interesting was in the afternoons when, like, her friends would come over, the aunties, as we call them, and they would drink tea and they would gossip and they'd talk about these dreams. And of course, as a young girl, it was not considered appropriate for me to listen to these dreams, which were about adult matters. But sometimes I hid behind the door and I listened anyway.
Tell me about the novel. Who Matters? What's it about?
This is kind of a family novel, a generational novel. There are three generations of this Indian-American family living in the San Francisco area. And there is Rakhi's mother, Mrs. Gupta, who is a dream interpreter in her community. And many people come to her for help with their dreams and therefore with the direction their lives might take. There is Rakhi, who is her daughter, who is a divorced mother herself and who lives in Berkeley. She owns a little tea shop. And she's also an artist. She's struggling to find her voice, her way of expression. And there's Rakhi's daughter, Jonah, who's just a child at this point. And we will find out some interesting things about Jonah as the story goes along. But Jonah's kind of torn in two between her mother and her father, Rakhi's ex-husband, Sonny. And the other important person in this novel is Rakhi's father, who really surprised me as the novel went along because he developed in some very unusual and interesting ways that I hadn't expected.
I think everybody is fascinated by dreams, but dreams carry more weight in this novel than they do in the world that I'm aware of, the more American world, I guess. Is there something special about the people in the family in your book that makes dreams so essential?
I think there is. And in Queen of Dreams, definitely the mother, who is a dream interpreter, she takes dreams very seriously, in some ways more so than her daughter, and definitely more so than her husband. But I think this also comes from a cultural view about dreams, where in the West, often dreams are used for maybe psychotherapy, for analysis, to figure out what one's problems are. In the East, and I think in many indigenous cultures, dreams are ways of seeing into the future and seeing into your deeper self, and often seen as very spiritual. It's like the spirit world speaking to us through the dream. And certainly the mother in Queen of Dreams, she experiences that, where animal spirits will come to speak to her, and especially a snake.
Now, you talk about your own childhood and your mother, who inserted mother wisdom, you call it, into the interpretation of dreams. Have you simply taken that and made it stronger, that idea in Queen of Dreams? Or is a dream teller something that you would find in Bengali culture?
You would find dream tellers. There are actual, like, professional dream tellers, and I have been to see a couple of them, especially as I was doing research for the book. There are also many books on dream telling, where these symbols that we've been talking about have appeared, and they're discussed very thoroughly with all of the combinations of meanings that they could stand for. So there's a real study of dream telling in the culture, and there are actually communities of dream tellers, though the dream caves that I have created in the Queen of Dreams are from my imagination, and in some ways they are a geographic space, but in some ways they're also an internal space. Mm.
You talk about having gone to see some Bengali dream tellers while you were doing the research for this novel. What were they like?
They were very interesting. I saw a couple of them. One of them was, you know, she was a very modern woman, and she had even a computer in which she would, you know, write in the dreams. And there was like a program that she had created where, you know, symbols would come up and meanings would come up. So that was like a dream telling for the 21st century. And then I went to see another one who was much more traditional and who had actually a parrot. And the parrot sat on her shoulder, and the parrot ate green chilies, which impressed me right away. And when someone would tell their dream to this dream teller, the parrot would whisper into her ear, and she said that the parrot was giving her direction. Now, I don't know how much of this was real and how much of this was for show, but I thought it was quite fascinating.
I'm not sure which one I trust more, the computer or the parrot.
Yes, perhaps the parrot should be trusted more.
There is a point where Mrs. Gupta involves Rakhi in her dreams. It's fairly early in the book. There is a warning that she gives to someone she doesn't know. I wonder if you'd read that for us.
Sure. And I wanted to just say that, so this is the other type of dream interpretation that Mrs. Gupta does when she dreams, and she dreams about people she doesn't even know. But then her duty as a dream teller is to find them and inform them of what is going to happen to them. In about 10 unsteady minutes, we'd reached the corner gas station. My mother walked around to the side where the public phone was located. She gripped the telephone and asked me to dial the number I had copied down. "Are you sure?" I asked, worried at the turn things were taking. "Do you even know this guy?" My mother shook her head. I could hear the ringing through the receiver. A gruff voice said, "Raghavendra speaking." "Mr. Raghavendra," my mother said, "I'm calling to inform you that your life is in danger. One of the people living in your house is planning to kill you." There was a silence at the other end. Then the voice, hissing and heavy, yet small and tinny at the same time, said, "Who is this?" My mother didn't say anything. "Is this a crank call? I'm going to phone the police. Have you traced?" "Mr. Raghavendra," my mother said, "you have to believe me. It's probably your cousin, whom you sponsored from India 6 months ago. He's been living in your house since then, right? Does his name start with the letter H?" Silence again. "I think he's developed a relationship with your wife and wants you out of the..." "How do you know this?" He sounded oddly calm. "I can't tell you that." "Someone's put you up to this, yes? A practical joke, yes? No joke, my mother said. Then you're crazy, he was shouting now. Completely nuts. I'm going to have you committed. I'm going to come after you personally. I found myself sobbing. I wasn't sure what I was more scared of, that the man would somehow learn who my mother was and find her, and by extension us, as he threatened, or that he was right, and she was crazy. I did my best, Mr. Raghavendra, my mother said sadly. Now it's up to you.
Chitra Banerjee Devakaruni is the author of the novel Queen of Dreams. She teaches creative writing at the University of Houston. So, think you're getting enough sleep? Think again.
The average American adult, for example, now sleeps just over 6 hours a night. Lots of chimpanzees and monkeys sleep considerably more than we do.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. While most of us are fascinated with dreams, hardly anyone gets enough sleep anymore. Writer Paul Martin is hoping to change that. He's the author of the book Counting Sheep. Martin told Steve Paulson that sleeping has a bad rap in today's busy society.
The current cultural pressures in modern Western society, the 24/7 society, really do treat sleep as though it were some kind of unproductive downtime that we'd all be better off doing without. You know, we work, and when we're not working, we're playing. And sleep is seen as something sort of best avoided. And one consequence of that is that in most modern developed nations, USA, the UK, European countries and so on, a lot of people are actually getting less sleep than they need to function optimally. And getting insufficient sleep over a long period has all sorts of damaging consequences, both psychologically and physically.
What kinds of consequences?
Well, psychologically, I mean, there are the sort of very obvious ones in terms of, for example, people's mood. I mean, people get grumpy when they're tired. But it affects, for example, their communication skills and their social skills. And there are more subtle consequences. I think one of the most intriguing discoveries of research in recent years has been evidence that people become less risk-averse when they're tired. They become more attracted by options that they might, you know, when they're not tired, avoid. And indeed, there are some fascinating parallels, very, very compelling parallels, between the effects of sleep deprivation and the effects of alcohol, in fact. Lots of research on people's driving ability, for example, shows that even quite moderate levels of sleep deprivation, you know, staying up very late or missing a night's sleep, has comparable effects on people's ability to drive a car safely, as does drinking levels of alcohol that would make it illegal for you to drive. But once again, our society has this kind of double standard. I mean, you know, drunk driving is not only socially unacceptable, it's illegal. Whereas we still tend to take the attitude of, you know, people will boast about the fact that, you know, they don't need much sleep or they can stay up all night and it doesn't affect their ability and so on. And it just isn't true.
Well, there are some politicians who've been celebrated for supposedly not having to sleep very much. I remember seeing the stories about Margaret Thatcher that I think she slept 4 hours a night or something like that, and that's why she was so productive. And I think Bill Clinton is said to not sleep very much either.
Yeah, certainly Mrs. Thatcher was much feted as somebody who supposedly didn't sleep very much. I found when looking into some of these, particularly some of the historical ones, I mean, Napoleon was another, what you find quite often is that, first of all, there's an element of mythology in all of this. because of this idea that sleep is somehow kind of weak and pointless, strong leaders don't like necessarily to project themselves as people who sort of spend a lot of time in bed. But also what you often find with people who allegedly don't sleep very much is that they do tend to nap quite a bit. And napping, sleeping during the day for short periods, can be a very effective way of helping to cope with not getting a lot of sleep at night. So there are other tactics that people can use for not having to sleep as much as they perhaps ought to.
Now, there are a few fascinating case studies of people who have intentionally tried to stay awake for days on end, and I guess, in fact, have stayed awake. And there's a story, for instance, of a DJ, I think it was back in 1959, a guy named Peter Tripp, who wanted to break the world record for staying awake the most number of hours. And I think he stayed awake for 200 hours or something like that.
That's right. And according to the accounts of it, I mean, it wasn't monitored by scientists, so the accounts are not what you would call reliable accounts, but he clearly had a horrible time. And it's a common experience of people who are sleep deprived, you know, that they eventually start to hallucinate. They see things and hear things, and they don't feel very well. And indeed, sleep deprivation is the oldest form of torture, and it's still widely practiced in many totalitarian regimes. It's a way of breaking even the strongest person. It's simply depriving them of sleep, constantly waking them up when they fall asleep. It's something, you know, beloved of secret police forces around the world, and it has been for thousands of years. There are examples from sort of ancient Chinese history of this being used as a technique for punishing people, for example. So it's a horrible thing to do to anybody, to deliberately deprive them of sleep. But as you say, some brave people have in the past set out to see how far they can go. And as far as I could tell, the record is still held by an American student called Randy Gardner, who I think, if I remember rightly, stayed awake for 11 days.
Will our bodies just shut down at a certain point if we don't get sleep? I mean, will we die?
Well, of course, you know, experiments have never been done to test that with humans, although in the 70s and 80s, experiments were done with rats, for example. And what they showed is that, yes, if you deprive an animal of sleep for long enough, in the case of rats, the researchers found, you know, 2 to 3 weeks, they die. And there are all sorts of rather unpleasant physical effects. For example, their metabolism goes to pieces. So they eat more and more and more, but get thinner and thinner and thinner. And their body temperature controls go wrong. And their skin condition starts to deteriorate. So there are sort of very visible physical effects, as well as what's going on in their brains. But yes, I mean, if you deprive a human of sleep for long enough, he or she would die.
One thing I found interesting as I was reading your book was that humans are actually kind of the low end of the spectrum in terms of how much we sleep in each day. I mean, there are some mammals that sleep, 13 hours a day or even up to 20 hours a day. And even gorillas sleep, I guess, 12 hours a day.
Oh, that's right. I mean, as I recall it, the champions are the two-toed sloths who notch up 20 hours a day, you know, which is 80% of their entire lives. Whereas actually three-toed sloths are much livelier. They only sleep, I think, about 17 hours a day. Lizards, you know, lots of animals that will sleep far more than 12 hours a day. And even if you sort of look at our immediate biological relatives, the other primates, we're at the sort of low to middle ground. And that's assuming we sleep 8 hours a day, the mythical 8 hours a day, which, of course, most people don't anymore. I mean, the research shows that, you know, the average American adult, for example, now sleeps just over 6 hours a night. So the 8 hour benchmark, again, is somewhat mythological. Lots of chimpanzees and monkeys sleep considerably more than we do.
You tell a great story about the pianist Artur Rubinstein, who apparently had a very hard time getting out of bed in the morning, and his wife had an ingenious solution. She would play the piano badly, I guess, unresolved chords, and he just couldn't take it, so he'd get out of bed and try to do it right.
Exactly, exactly. One of the other interesting differences between individuals is the so-called owls versus larks. We all have biological clocks in us, which, you know, tell us it's time to go to bed and time to wake up. And the settings differ. So some people are naturally happier going to bed pretty early and getting up very early. And some people, and I'm one of these, are owls. We, you know, like to go to bed late and get up late. But society, again, tends to sort of look down its nose at people who, you know, lie in bed in the morning. As you said earlier, it's seen as somehow disreputable. It's a sort of sign of laziness. Equally, napping during the day. Very good evidence that short napping during the day is terrific. It makes people feel better and actually, you know, they perform better at their jobs. So if you're an enlightened employer, you'd be encouraging your staff to sleep during the day, you know, for 15, 20 minutes. But again, the attitude is one of saying this is dreadful. It's like being drunk or something at work. It's seen as something to be criticised for. It's assumed that you're ill or lazy or something. The attitudes towards sleep are, I think, just wrong in society at the moment.
Now, you sound like a bit of a sleep evangelist. And I guess maybe part of the reason is you're really suggesting that when you come right down to it, sleep is just very pleasurable.
Well, exactly. I suppose I became a bit of an evangelist just simply as a result of learning what I learned researching the book. It's actually very compelling when you find out what the evidence shows. And yes, on the one hand, it shows sleep is very biologically important and all sorts of ghastly things will happen to you if you don't get enough of it. But on the other hand, and I think this is equally important, sleep as a neglected source of pleasure. And if you look back into some of the sort of historical and anthropological literature, and you realise the role that sleeping and dreaming and dozing and napping played in human life throughout most of our history. You know, the sheer pleasure that that can bring, the pleasure, for example, of, you know, indulging in dreaming. And we've lost a lot of that. I mean, a lot of people have lost that because of the way we now, or a lot of us now, live our lives. So you can be pragmatic about it and say, you know, I'll do better at work and feel happier and get on with people better if I get enough sleep. But equally, you could say, well, actually, I'll get pleasure if I take sleep slightly more seriously as well. It's a neglected source of pleasure.
Paul Martin is the author of the book Counting Sheep. He spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Tim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, and Doug Gordon, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Owen. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Perchance to Dream, number 926A. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Have you ever wondered why Homer's Iliad is still so popular? Best-selling writer Thomas Cahill says it's because it's a real boy's story. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on the Peabody Award-winning program To the Best of Our Knowledge, our enduring fascination with the ancient Greeks. Also an archaeologist who's excavating the real Troy. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.